What's up, guys? Welcome back to West Coast Bias, Season 4, Episode 8. Back for a second week in a row to do part two of our NBA preview. Last week we did our top 50 players. This week we're going to count down how we think the conferences are going to play out, what the rankings are going to be. We're going to go over all our potential playoff teams from 8 to 1 in each conference, and we're going to go over the roster configuration, and then also one player that we think could make a difference, positive or negative, depending on how well they play this year. We're going to start with the West because the East is tragic and no one cares about it. Once again, just like the players we did last week, we aggregated the two and averaged our rankings for our individual rankings. So we'll go over the rankings that were aggregated together and then what we each had individually. We're going to start in the West with number 8, who are the Sacramento Kings. Hunter had them at 7. I had them at 9, that was more just because I had to keep the Spurs in there. I think there's a very good chance that the Kings can make it. I think that they're more talented than the Spurs, but the Spurs keep seeming to make it. They have all they're all healthy this year, so I'm keeping them in at 8. But let's talk about the Kings for now. Give us the Kings overview, just right off the bat.
So the Kings obviously won 39 games last year, which was a lead to something like 4th from the year before. Unfortunately, they were in position. They were 8th going into the All-Star break. It's the only time I believe they were in the playoffs all year, actually. It was for that 4 days. Unfortunately for them, the Clippers caught fire pretty quickly after that, since they got significantly better after trading Tobias Harris somehow. And the Kings sort of fell off in the last 10 games, and realistically their record probably should have landed around 42. They lost their last 3 in a row, and something I believe like 7 of their last 10. I consider them around a 500 team for last year. This year I have them pegged at an easy 45 wins. Whether or not that's enough to get into the playoffs in the West is really up to your interpretation. I have the Spurs at around 40, and I have the Warriors actually at 43, which is why I have them at 7. But I have them pretty comfortably behind everybody ahead of them, who have between 48 and 60. Realistically 48 and 55, with the Nuggets at 60. I have the Kings really relying on the production of their top 3 players, because the depth behind them is frankly spectacular. They don't have any excellent players after their top 3. It's not like they're the Warriors or anything. But they do have very good starters down to 7. They have, coming off their bench, Demi Bielica and Bogdan Bogdanovic. Bielica being probably the best player on the team for the first 30 games of last season, and an elite stretch 4 who does just enough on defense to justify being out there, but certainly can't defend 5s or 3s, but when he plays the 4 he can do enough, and he shoots something like 44%, something like 50% on open shots, which is really all you need from that position. Bogdanovic was the best player in the FIBA World Cup this year, pretty comfortably so. He was on a team with Nikola Jokic, who I think we can all agree is a better basketball player, but was comfortably better than him in that tournament. It's better than anybody on Team USA. It was better than anybody on the Spanish team. And if they hadn't gotten knocked out in a quarterfinal game, would have easily won MVP over Ricky Rubio, who actually did win that award. And then when the actual starting lineup, they've added Dwayne Dedmon, essentially to replace Bielica's role, even though he defends centers. He's not really replacing Willie Cauley-Stein so much as bad. He's replacing Cauley-Stein, but what he does is all he does is he defends the 5. He's fast enough to go out to the perimeter if he needs to, though that's not really what he's best at. He hits 3s at an amazing rate, 40% from, I believe, 41 maybe, from the corners, and 38 overall. He played for the Hawks, the Spurs, and the Magic, so he had a long journey to get to the point where he could be a starter somewhere, but he's here now. And he's joined by Harrison Barnes, the other quality starter on this team. Harrison Barnes, of course, we all know exactly what he is now. He's really just a 3 and D guy who defends other wings at an elite level and hits his 3s at 41%, which is really all you need from him. He's still an excellent isolation scorer, but that's not this offense at all, and realistically, if Luke Walton has him doing that, it's going to be a problem for the team. And then, of course, that pretty much means that this is going to be decided, won or lost, by this top 3. We all have a pretty good idea of what De'Aaron Fox and Buddy Hield are, so I'm not really going to harp on them for too long. I think Fox is a borderline all-star, really just depends on depth in the West, would comfortably be an all-star in the East. I'm projecting something like a 20-8 season for him. He shot 37% from 3 last year, which is to say that his biggest issue is no longer an issue. And Buddy Hield is the second best healthy shooter in the NBA, because the only two between him and Steph Curry are both former Warriors players who are going to be out for the season. He is a 46% 3-point shooter. I think he cooled down to 44 by the end of last year, but he was at 46 until about game 60, which is unreal. It is what would be considered a top 10 all-time shooting season. Only problem is that Steph also had a top 10 all-time shooting season last year, so there's no real public interest in it. That pretty much just leaves Marvin Bagley as the X factor. He's starting for the first time in his career last year. He was basically a bench spark plug, but he averaged 20-10 per 36. He really didn't get that much usage, even though he should have, because there was this whole issue where a certain previous coach who may or may not have been fired after a successful season refused to play rookies, which is also an issue with Harry Giles. So realistically, what they need is Marvin Bagley to make a star jump. He needs to take that production to 36 minutes. He needs to be able to defend wings and bigs. He needs to be able to block shots and help, which is something he was really, really good at when he was playing the four last season. And he needs to be able to shoot his threes just well enough that it's not a problem. And he actually shot 40% from three after the All-Star break last year, so I'm not sure that's that much of a concern.
Yeah, so my question with the Kings, do you think that Fox is like a guy you can give the ball to at the end of the game now, or is that something that he's going to develop into? Because my thing with the Kings is they have a lot of talent, obviously a lot of young talent, but I look at them and I don't know who's taking the last shot quite yet. I think I don't watch enough Kings games to know how they handled that last year at all, but I would imagine it's probably Fox going to have the ball in his hand, but is it someone like Hield who's going to take the last shot, or Bogdanovich, or how do you think that's going to play out this year?
Pretty much the plan for that situation is you run basically four guards. You take out Deadman and you replace him with Bogdanovich. And what they did last year was they primarily spaced the floor and isolated Fox. That's how they beat the Grizzlies, is Fox guarded Mike Conley one-on-one in that situation, stopped him, and then hit a jumper over him 3 seconds later to win the game. But the two more iconic game winners they had last season were trick ATO plays to get open threes for Bogdanovich and Hield. Hield hit one off 1 foot. Bogdanovich hit one from about 36 feet to each win games. And I'm not entirely sure that's really going to be so much of a plan going forward. That's very much less a Luke Walton thing and more of a Dave Yeager thing. If it's like a situation where they have the ball with 15 seconds left, they're going to run probably just a Fox Bagley pick and roll, not the play develop, and maybe go to one of the open shooters if need be. But if it's a situation with 2 seconds left, it'll probably still be Hield or Bogdanovich. That's the nice thing about having so many shooters.
Right. So do you have faith, though, that if someone's – like all these other playoff teams have one or two guys for the most part, they're going to get the ball. You know, the Nuggets have Murray and Jokic. The Jazz have Conley and Mitchell. Clippers obviously have Kawhi and George. Rockets have Westbrook and Harden. Blazers have Lillard and McCollum. Lakers have Braun, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think that's an issue for them? Because I know when they played the Blazers at least last year, I think they had the lead on the Blazers in two separate games and blew them at least one of the times because they just couldn't score down the stretch and either Lillard or McCollum just took over. Is that going to be something that you're worried about at all, or do you think it's going to be better this year?
That's really going to come down to coaching. I think the players are fine. The half-court offense really, really was sluggish last year. And they got forced into the half-court offense in those situations. And because the half-court offense was essentially just either Fox, Willie Cauley-Stein pick and roll, and then Cauley-Stein did not know what to do when it failed, or they would give Cauley-Stein the ball in the elbow and try to find a hand up to either Fox or to Hield. I really don't think that's going to be the situation this year. I mean, Bagley's a much more dynamic player. He's the sort of guy you can go to score one-on-one if need be if no one else is working. And that's also why you have Bogdanovich. He can come off the bench and score in isolation if need be in those situations. They have a lot of options. I really think there's a chance that it could still work out just fine, so I'm not too worried about that. I do understand that this is a concern. They did also blow 3 of 4 games to the Warriors that exact way. They should have won all 4. 3 of them, they were leading with 2 minutes left.
Well, the Kings are obviously very high on everyone's league pass list, and they could very well be legitimately good this year. I think they are certainly better. I think the Pelicans are getting extremely overhyped. The Mavs really only have 2 players. The Thunder could be decent if Paul sticks around, but I don't think they have the longevity or the staying power. So I think it really comes down to the Spurs and the Kings for that last spot, in my mind, depending on how the Warriors' injury situation plays out. But that's a good segue to our 7th team, which is the Warriors. You had them at 8, I had them at 7. I don't know how well the Russell Curry thing is going to work out, but I think Curry's going to win the MVP this year. I actually think he should be. If he's not, I think he should be favored, pretty reasonably favored, actually. Even in the preseason, we've seen he's just going to try to take over. So if he can stay healthy and be durable, I think they're going to be fine. If they can get Clay back by the end of the year, like we mentioned in the player preview, obviously depth is the big issue with them. I don't, Alphonso McKinney starting at three is an issue. I'm not quite as worried about the Russell Curry backcourt. I think that they're good enough and the system's good enough and the culture's good enough that that'll work out fine. I do think there's a variance in between good Russell and really good Russell that could kind of push them between the seventh or eighth spot and the fifth or sixth spot. But I think it's going to mainly just depend on if they can hang around. I don't think any of our top teams are going to want to play them as a 2 or a 7 or 2-7 or 1-8 or 3-6 matchup. No one's going to want to play the Warriors in the first round of the playoffs.
Yeah, I would certainly agree that they're not a fun first round of the playoff team, especially if they get Klay Thompson back in April, which is much more likely than him coming back in early March. But for me, it's, I don't think this is a good team at all, specifically because Steph Curry would need to win MVP for them to even make the playoffs, which is very likely still. But outside of Steph Curry, they have two all-star level players who don't mesh together at all. Draymond Green really, really, really loses his usefulness on a bad team, and if this is ends up playing like a bad team, it's going to be a problem. Their starting small forward is Alphonso McKinney right now, I believe. Starting center will be hopefully not Willie Cauley-Stein, but if he comes back early and they do not have their much better center, Kevon Looney, back in time, starting center is going to be Willie Cauley-Stein, which is to say they have three players on this team. And Sean Livingston loss, I think, is a very big deal. Obviously, a much bigger deal is the Andre Iguodala loss, and the unquestionably much larger deal is the Kevin Durant loss. You combine those three, though, and you're losing three great defensive players, and you're really looking at what used to be this team's identity as defense and three-point shooting. Obviously, they still have two great shooters in Russell and Steph Curry, and once he comes back, they'll have Klay Thompson, too. But if you look at that starting lineup outside of those two players, there's not a shooter to be found. Omari Spellman might be the third best shooter in that lineup. Draymond Green, famously not a shooter, famously much more of a playmaker. Steph Curry can run a pick and roll with a Kevon Looney or Willie Cauley-Stein. That'll probably be more D'Angelo Russell's doing, at which point you're using Steph Curry essentially just as a shooting guard, as a spacer, which is kind of a waste of an MVP. D'Angelo Russell's so much less useful in that role. He's much more of a Kyrie Irving type than he is anything else. And then you have to really look at the fact that this was a, used to be a defensive team, and they went from having the famous best defensive lineup ever, which was the one before they got Kevin Durant. Even though Durant is a better defender, they're, I believe the individual best net rating defensive season of the last 20 years was that death lineup with Harrison Barnes, when they still had Barnes, Iguodala, Curry, Clay, and Draymond. Now they have two of those players left, and they have nobody who can defend in that way and switch everything like that and really run their defensive identity anymore. Steph Curry used to be good enough that you could hide him. Now that he's going to be the fourth most important defender rather than the fifth most, it's going to be much harder. D'Angelo Russell's obviously very flawed on that end. A team like the Kings could absolutely torch them just because they're going to have two prime matchups every time they go down the court, to say nothing of the Rockets, who have two elite isolation scorers in those positions. And if you actually get into a playoff matchup, they're scary because they're the Warriors. But at the end of the day, if Klay Thompson's not back and healthy, and this is the team they're starting, and the Warriors are at 7 and the Jazz are at 2, the Jazz are not going to be scared of the Warriors because Mike Conley's going to drop 22 a game on them.
Yeah, well, see, I'm not quite as pessimistic as that as you are on them. I think, and this is a big if, I think if Curry stays healthy, I really think that they'll be fine. They should get – people are coming back from ACLs much faster nowadays. Just in the last few years, I think that the ACL
rehab process is – 2 years.
What's that?
Except for Kristaps Porzingis, who took 2 years.
Yeah, well, he's – very injury prone and also 7 feet tall. But I think, you know, in a lot of sports, it used to be a guaranteed 12 months out. Now it's more like 8 or 9. Klay Thompson is somebody who doesn't have just the high, like a very, you know, he's not always handling the ball. He's not doing all the things that a main ball handler has to do that might be harder on a knee in general. I think if they can hold on and if Curry can stay healthy, I think they'll comfortably be at least a 7th seed. I just think they can figure it out. If they might not be able to, it might go downhill very fast, but I don't see them falling out of the playoff race without another injury happening, but we'll see. In 6th, we both agreed on the Los Angeles Lakers, who are 6th in our rankings, probably because A, there's 5 teams that we think are better, but also just because we're not sure how much Davis, who's already hurt, is going to play, how much LeBron is going to play, and then obviously the mismatch of supporting characters.
I think it's fair to say that we think both the Warriors and the Lakers are bad teams with great players?
I don't think the Warriors are a bad team. I don't think they're as deep, but I think they're still a good team. I think the Lakers are actually kind of the opposite of... I think the Lakers actually have more depth than they're getting credit for. It's just their depth is a bunch of either old has-beens or players like Avery Bradley and Danny Green who can either be really good or really, really bad. I think the Danny Green signing was actually really underrated. He was a crucial part of that Toronto team last year. He's not only a top five shooter in the league, but he's also arguably a top six or seven defender. Fits really, really well next to LeBron and Davis. So if just having Green, LeBron and Davis, if that's a lineup they can have, is going to win them a lot of games, in my opinion. I think, and this probably speaks to the kind of the dysfunction that could be, I think Avery Bradley is somehow the kind of linchpin. If he can get back to somewhat to how the Celtics was on the Celtics and not shoot as much, but, you know, play lockdown defense, which is obviously something that they're going to really struggle with LeBron, who's been extremely lazy on defense for 3 to 4 years, and just not a whole lot of defense on the rest of that team, that can make a huge difference. Obviously, Kuzma is there, but we don't know exactly what he can do. Cannot play defense, extremely inefficient on offense, doesn't really seem to fit next to LeBron or Davis particularly well. I think six is the right, there's a high variation with this Lakers team. They could easily finish higher than this, and they could easily really miss the playoffs if some injury stuff goes wrong, and Davis already has a thumb injury, which is a very Anthony Davis type injury to have.
Right, it's not hard to see a situation in which if things don't click, Davis only plays 40 games, LeBron only plays 60 games, and Davis leaves in free agency. It's also not hard to see a situation in which they win a championship. It's just, I can't see either of those extremes as nearly as likely as them having a mediocre 48-win season and kind of disappointing in the playoffs. Because at the end of the day, they're asking two guys who, one of them hasn't actually been injured, only been injured once in the last 5 years, really, or twice in the last 5 years, I suppose. But the other has been injured every single season, and James has needed to play about 65 games to 60 games to stay rested, to not get injured in those situations. And you're asking them to basically, if they're playing with one injured, half of these games, only one of these two players is going to be playing. And I really don't think it works. I think we saw very firmly with the Pelicans that Anthony Davis, one good 3-and-D player, and then three guys doesn't work. Because Jrue Holiday is better than Danny Green at everything that Danny Green does. And that did not help them win any games. And it's pretty clear that LeBron plus Danny Green is not a bad combination, but winning the East in 2017 is not the same thing as winning games in the West in 2020. I'm not super, super confident in them doing anything. I'm really, really down on Kuzma, and I'm very high on Danny Green, as you mentioned, but past that, we're talking about seven players we need to have. Basically, they need, if things shake right this season, from six or seven players to have any real depth. We're talking about Avery Bradley being a key piece for them. We're talking about him as a possible starter. We're talking about Rondo is mattering. We're talking about Dwight Howard is mattering. JaVale McGee is mattering. JaVale McGee, by the way, had a sneaky bad season last year. He's a guy that a lot of people talked about as being sneaky good for the first 20 games of last season. But if you actually go back and look at the total of that season, he was a bad basketball player. And they're probably going to end up asking him to start at five next to Anthony Davis, where he's essentially in a redundant role. And it hurts what Davis can do on offense because McGee doesn't stretch the floor. I just have a lot of concerns about this team. I mean, they could easily win 60 games if something goes crazy, everything goes right, but I do not think they will.
Yeah. Next at five, we have the Houston Rockets. I had them at four, you had them at five. From the brief amount of preseason we've seen, it looks like Westbrook and Harden aren't going to have a super difficult time playing alongside each other. They seem to enjoy playing with each other, which is obviously, you know, 75% of the issue. The rest, they should be able to figure out. I started out with them actually higher, but then I realized I had the top two teams I had, I think, are going to have much better regular seasons, and it might take a little bit of time for the Rockets to figure it out, and they, again, are pretty short on depth all over the roster outside of those two. It's a pretty similar situation. We talked about Chris Paul and how we think he's undervalued even at this stage in his career. They don't have Chris Paul anymore. So while I think Harden and Westbrook is actually going to work out all right, maybe lowering Harden's usage and Westbrook's usage simultaneously could work better. It seems like Morey Ball is kind of already starting to eliminate some of those horrible Westbrook mid-ranges that we saw for the last 10 years of his career. I don't think anyone really knows how this is going to work, but I'm actually, a lot of people seem to think it's either going to go really, really badly or really, really poorly or really, really well. I think it's perfectly conceivable that they end up right where we have them at five, and it goes pretty well, and there's stretches where the offense looks a little dysfunctional, and there's stretches where they look completely unbeatable.
Yeah, I mean, they have two top 15-ish players. That's pretty much all I'll keep that to for me is the fit's a little weird, but they like each other, and they're players who the biggest issues they've ever had playing with people were not liking people. I think we saw that both with Chris Paul and Victor Oladipo never really clicked. But then together, I don't think it's much of a problem. I think Harden's essentially back to being a nominal shooting guard, but for both of them, it's one decent player who can do just enough off ball, two great floor spacers, and one great pick and roll center, and that's basically the system they played in their whole lives, both of them. The only difference is that for Harden, sometimes that decent player was like a Jeremy Grant. For Westbrook, sometimes the decent player was like Jeremy Grant. And for Harden, it's usually been Chris Paul or an Eric Gordon or somebody who's a little bit more useful. So I think this is actually an improvement for Westbrook.
Yeah.
I'm high on this team in the playoffs. I think a lot of people aren't. But I'm high on this team in the playoffs just because they have two elite isolation scorers. And I'm high enough that I felt pretty comfortable putting them at five. It's just that I think the next four teams are special.
Yeah, see, my thing is with the Rockets is I think Westbrook off ball, which everyone has kind of for his whole career has just been like, there's no way he doesn't like doing it, he won't do it. I don't think there's really been a whole lot of evidence of that, except for when he was with Durant early in his career. But I think he's perfectly capable, like we've both said, if he likes playing with Harden, he could be a really devastating off ball player with back cuts and, you know, just even pick and rolls with him and Harden could be an interest. I've seen a few of those in preseason, which have been kind of crazy to see. I think him off ball could actually be something that we see this year a lot more than, I mean, obviously we're going to see it because Harden's going to be on ball so much, but rather than having them staggered, I think we're going to see a lot of Russ just running around the court as fast as he can and distracting people and opening up lanes for Harden. At four, we have the Blazers, who I had at five and you had at four. They've looked really, really bad for the most part in the preseason, which I don't really take a lot of stock in. But they have a really tough road-heavy first 15-20 games of the season. And I think they're really going to struggle. I think they're probably going to go about 500 over the first 20 games of the season, which I think it makes it really hard for them to finish in the top four, which is why I have them at five. I think they will figure it out. Zach Collins has looked amazing in the preseason. He's been really the best player, one of the best players on the team in the preseason. I think once they get it figured out, they're going to be really awesome offensively and probably not a whole lot worse or even better off or defensively. But right now they look defensively really, really horrible. They lost Aminu and Harkless, who were total liabilities on offense, but they were both guys who can defend the perimeter on defense, which they have not been doing at all. No one's been doing at all. I think the Suns hit about 26 threes in the preseason game the other day. I think the difference make a lot of people have been talking about Anthony Simons, and he's been very good, and I think he's going to be a 10 to 15 point scorer off the bench. He's looked perfectly capable of ball handling off the bench, and scoring off the bench and assisting and doing all that stuff. But the player that actually is going to make the difference is Zach Collins. His shooting stroke looks much faster. It's not as much Myers-Leonard syndrome. He's got a mid-range jumper now, which looks awesome. He's gotten about 30 pounds heavier for the second straight season, which has made a huge difference defensively and in rebounding. He's going to start this year for the first time in his career alongside Whiteside. So defensively, interior-wise, they're going to be very difficult to get past, as both those guys are extremely, extremely talented shot blockers and very good rebounders. CJ, my bold prediction for the Blazers season is that CJ averages over 25 points. I think that Denver series really kind of gave him a lot of confidence because he finally got the national recognition that he deserves. But I think it's
a little too much in ESPN's case.
Right. And it's, at least through the preseason, and we saw it at the end of the playoffs, I think Lillard needs a break a lot of times. And CJ's also added more threes to his game, as he's been talking about that a lot. So not that we're going to see less of a mid-range, but he's also gotten bigger as well, so he's going to try to go into the – he's trying to draw more fouls than he ever has. He's going to shoot more threes. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see a lot more of CJ late in games, with Dame kind of facilitating and being off the ball a little more. And then I think the most interesting thing is who gets staggered with who. Is it going to be Lillard with Simons, or McCollum with Simons, or Mario Hezonja with Simons? All these different things. The worry for Blazers fans is obviously the depth pieces are very uncertain, to say the least. We have Hezonja, we have Scott Labissiere, who seems like he's actually going to get legitimate time. Anthony Tolliver, who's played for 15 different teams in his life. Simons is somehow probably the most certain of the players off the bench in terms of what we're going to see from him. But I think, like I said, I think that the issue is that I think they're going to struggle, especially defensively, in the first 10 to 15 games of the season. I think they'll get it figured out, but I think 5-6 feels about right. I think the four teams that I have above them, and certainly the three teams that we haven't spoken about yet, just have more talent, more depth, and more defensive ability than the Blazers do. That'll make them more consistent regular season teams, at least.
For me, it's assuming Nurkic comes back by game 40. I think if they can stay at 500 until game 40, every single year they seem to go crazy from games 40 to 70. That just seems to be the Blazers' biorhythm or something. And if you're talking about a lineup where you're suddenly replacing Hassan Whiteside on a team that's already winning with Jusuf Nurkic, that's a very, very nice improvement. I really am a big believer in Collins. I wasn't a believer until these playoffs, but I really saw what I was hoping to see from him. It's a little bit of a shame that we no longer have the Facebook Twins starting lineup. That was briefly possible when Nurkic was hurt, but that's okay. We split up the Twins, and so I guess the other guy's in Miami now as part of that trade.
Yes, I think he's going to be start. I think he's going to be. I think Myers Leonard is going to be Miami starting center this year alongside Bam Adebayo, which actually not a bad fit. We'll talk about Miami a little later.
I like that. Yeah, shout out to Edric Adebayo and Myers Leonard. What names? I couldn't put them lower than four. I really was debating between them and the Rockets, but I just think they're a better regular season team. I think they've proven to be an excellent regular season team, maybe more so than a playoff team, because they've been a great playoff team pretty consistently the past 3 years. So that's why I have them at four. But again, for me, it's just the next three teams are immediate, unquestioned championship contenders. The Blazers, Rockets, and Lakers are all have question marks.
Yeah, so we actually have the exact same top three. We'll start with the Clippers. At least on my, I mean, I think if load management pending, I would have them above the Jazz, who are our second team. We'll get to them shortly. But I don't know if it doesn't seem like Paul George is going to start the season. We saw how Kawhi had to be managed last year. I don't think it'll be any different this year after playing an entire NBA playoffs series for two extra months. I think there's a real chance they throw away games by holding both of them out at random times, or don't play them against bad teams, or you know, whatever, good teams or whatever it may be. They have depth. My hot take though is that I think the if they don't win this season, I think they're going to be in big trouble. I don't even know if that's a hot take, but I think that the amount they gave up for Kawhi and George, while entirely necessary and a good move, could really be a problem as soon as a year from now.
They only have each for 2 years, correct?
Yes, and they don't have anything past that. And I was actually looking at their roster today. They have the some of the same depth. They have you know, four or five pretty good bench players. They have Harkless, Harrell, Lou Williams, Landry Shamet, and Zubats still. Which is a pretty good seven-man rotation. But beyond that, we're talking kind of Jerome Robinson and Jermichael Green and some players who, you know, when Kawhi and George get injured, they're going to have to start relying on those guys, and I don't know how I feel about that. Obviously, I think they're definitely a much better playoff team than regular season team in my eyes.
Yeah, I would agree they're a much better playoff team. I think we agree comes down to the fact that, especially with, it looks like, Paul George was in the first 10 games of the season. It seems very easy to project those two as playing 60 each. But they do have Montrezl Harrell and Williams, who are would be the two best players on something like 7 of 15 Eastern Conference teams, and are coming off the bench here. To be fair, they were the two best players on this team last year and came off the bench, which is absurd to think about. But you're right, they have lost some depth. Obviously, they gave up Tobias Harris a while ago. They had to give up two very good players, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Danilo Gallinari, to get back Paul George. But much more important than that, obviously, is that they had to give up something, what, five first-round picks when you count the swaps and everything, which is a brutal, brutal flip for what's essentially a two-year shot at it. But it's better than the Lakers, who did the same thing for a one-year shot at it and will probably lose LeBron next offseason no matter what, either through aging out of relevancy or as a free agent. Either way, the two LA teams are both in win-now mode, which is going to be very, very interesting. Particularly since, while I do have the Clippers winning the championship, I do have them as a three seed because I do think they're a worse regular season team than the next two.
Yeah, and the it'll be interesting to read kind of the looking back, hindsight's 2020 pieces on probably both the Lakers and the Clippers in 2 years if they don't, or if they do win the titles, because they're both in just so much trouble if they don't manage to win a title. And there's enough talented teams, both at the top, very top of the East and throughout the Western Conference, that there's, you know, I think it's, I'd put it about 40% chance that one of those, maybe even lower than that, 30-40% that one of those two teams wins the title this year. So I'm sure there's plenty of prop bets out there about whether an LA team wins and how far they're going to get. But the team above them, we both had the Jazz. I have the Jazz. I think the Jazz are the darling. They've been the darling for a few years now. I think I love Mike Conley. It'll be interesting to see how he plays with Mitchell, though. I don't think this team is still quite there in terms of being a title contender. I don't really see that quite yet, but I can see why people would think so. It's going to, I think, depend on A, if Gobert can play in the playoffs, which is something we talked about when we were talking about Gobert last week, and also if Donovan Mitchell can look as good as he did this summer and how well he fits in with Conley, because I love Joe Ingles. I love the Bogdanovich signing. They now have shooting, which was a major issue when Mitchell wasn't on last season. They're extremely loaded. Lost Derek Favors, I think, was their only real loss to the Pelicans. They're shaping up to be a really, really awesome regular season team. The only issue I see with regular season with both the Jazz and the team we'll talk about next is that they're an extremely loaded division with three of our top four teams all playing in the West, all playing in the same division.
Right, but Thunder are the fifth team, which is a nice bonus.
Yeah, but I don't think the Thunder are going to be an easy game, at least for the first half of the season. But I don't know.
My big thing with the Jazz is that they are the first team we've looked at today with a complete starting five. They have great players at five positions. Their wings being Bogdanovich and Ingles. Ingles is a perfect fifth starter. He's a 3-and-D guy who is shockingly good at both of those things. You could watch him and not realize how great he is, because he just is invisible on that floor, but he does everything he needs to do. Bogdanovich, I do have some concerns about fit-wise, because he was at his best last season when he needed the ball. He was at his best last season when Oladipo was out. Now he's going to be the third favorite for the ball, which could become a problem, but I really don't think it is. And then obviously they have three players who have combined zero All-Star appearances, who are all better than all but maybe four players in the entire Eastern Conference, coming out and playing at the 1, 2, and 5, which are very, very, very interesting things. Obviously, Gobert is the best shot blocker in the league. Has some concerns about him in the playoffs, but he's a great player. Obviously, like you said, great, great, great summer for not Mike Conley, the other guy, Donovan Mitchell. Great summer for Donovan Mitchell playing for Team USA. And Mike Conley has been waiting to be on a title contender for 4 years since the Grizzlies really fell apart, and he's just been sitting there watching the wreckage collapse for years. So it's very exciting for all those players. Only problem is that they're not the Nuggets, and that they are very unproven outside of Conley in big game situations. The Jazz have won one playoff series, I believe. Actually, they've won two, but one was with back when they first had, instead of Mitchell, they had still Gordon Hayward. So they've won two playoff series in their period of being good. So I'm not entirely sure that they're a team that's going to take themselves to the Eastern Conference Finals or Western Conference Finals. But, you know, they've got talent. They've got a 1-5. They've got decent bench players. Obviously, Derek Favors is a big loss. Favors was their best bench player last year. Once they realized pretty quickly he couldn't really play with Gobert, they found a pretty good use for him. Unfortunately, he's going to be doing that for the Pelicans now instead.
Yeah, so our number one team we both agree on as well is the Nuggets. I think they're kind of unquestionably the deepest team in the league. They also have a complete starting five, with Murray, Harris, is it Beasley or Craig that starts? One of the two. Beasley. One of the two.
I think it's Beasley, but yeah, they're both good.
And then Jokic, obviously at five. We discussed when we were talking about Murray the other day, he's kind of the make or break for them. If he can be the guy that can take a load off of Jokic, both in the regular season and in the playoffs, and if he can live up to the contract he got there, I think they should be the title favorites. I think that how they played in the playoffs last year as kind of their rookie season in the playoffs was extremely impressive. Jokic looked fantastic. Murray, for the most part, looked really good. Little disappointed Gary Harris. I thought after his first year or two, I thought he was going to be a much better player, but he kind of disappeared. Obviously, he's had quite a few injuries, just kind of niggling injuries. So he's a guy that if he's really good, I think he could take them up even another level. A lot of people have been talking about one of two things, or about two of two things. The potential for Michael Porter Jr. to be a swing player, which I just cannot see in any way, shape, or form. I don't think he's gonna. I think he's gonna get injured again. Just that family has just such a horrible history of injuries, and he himself has such a horrible history of injuries. It just doesn't seem promising for him. I hope he can play, but even if he does, he hasn't played meaningful minutes ever in his entire life for any team ever. So I don't see him being a swing piece. The other thing people have been talking about is maybe the opportunity to trade for someone like Bradley Beal, a type of Michael Porter Jr., Jamal Murray type swap. I don't know if they'd do that in the first place, but I think the Nuggets as built, I would keep them how they are. Obviously, they have Paul Millsap, who's that we didn't mention when we were going over the lineup still, but he's obviously still a crucial piece. Really, really like the Nuggets this year after being a little lukewarm on them for 2 years. Mike Malone's a great coach for them. I don't see it. I think they're locked into a conference finals unless they get really unlucky.
Yeah, I would agree. I think you pretty much nailed it on the head when you said their playoff performance was really underrated just because of how it ended. Nikola Jokic played over an hour actually in a game after everybody was worried about his conditioning. I think we've gotten to the point where we can safely say that Nikola Jokic just looks like that, and that has nothing to do with how good he is as a basketball player. Same with the fact that, as somebody once famously said, he looks like he plays some flip-flops. He does. It works for him. I have the third in MVP voting, only for basically for narrative reasons. I think he could easily be the MVP of the season. And the problem I have with this team, the biggest problem I have with this team, is that it's really, really relying on Murray to be consistent in the playoffs. He's a fundamentally inconsistent player. But obviously, he's very good. He does a lot of things very well. I really could not see this team anywhere but first in the West. As much as I like the Jazz, this team's just got everything going for it. Paul Millsap, old man, still does everything very well. Perfect pairing for Nikola Jokic. Only real concern I have, I think you mentioned outside of Murray, is Gary Harris really has been pretty consistently hurt for the past season and a half, which isn't something you want from a guy who's theoretically going to be your third best player. You don't really want to be getting those touches from Will Barton instead, but Nuggets are still my number one in the West.
Yeah, we didn't even mention Jeremy Grant, who is the hipster blogger's ideal signing this summer. I don't think he's going to be quite as influential as some people seem to be thinking, but he's certainly a really great player to be able to bring off the bench and play at the end of games in small ball lineups. He's an underrated shooter. I think he shoots about 38-39% from three, and off the bench, all he'll have to do is be able to be asked to defend probably the best player on the opposing team and then stay in the corner and shoot threes, which is pretty much what he's made for. On the Thunder, that didn't work out so well because no one could shoot. But on the Nuggets, they do not have that problem with they could theoretically trot out a bench lineup of just really incredible defensive bench lineup with what's his name? Iowa State guy.
Monte Morris,
Torrey Craig, Will Barton, Mason Plumlee, and Jermichael Green, which maybe is a little short offensively, but that's a really disastrous lineup defensively or offensively.
You swap Jermichael Green for Michael Porter Jr. All of a sudden, you've been to an offense if he's healthy.
Yeah. I think they go 10 deep. I think they're really. We saw even last year how they were able to you know, withstand injuries to Millsap and Harris and Barton and all these players. And they're, you know, even if two of their three best players goes down, I think they're still a playoff team, unless not Jokic, yeah. But any of the other two, I think they're fine. Okay, so that wraps up the Western Conference. We'll be back in just a second for a much more abbreviated version for the East. All right, we're back for the Eastern Conference. We're probably going to zoom through the first four teams, then maybe spend a little bit more time on the top four. Our eighth team in the East is the Detroit Pistons. I did not have them in the playoffs. You had them at seven. I didn't have them in the playoffs because they have one good player, and that's Blake Griffin. And while Blake Griffin's been extremely impressive, they literally have no other good players on the entire roster. Reggie Jackson is their second best player.
Yeah, that's spot on. You're 100% correct in that. I think the difference is just how much I value Blake Griffin. I think Blake Griffin's about the fifth best player in basketball in a regular season standpoint, just as a guy who put up numbers. We have him at, 18 in our ranking, which is too high for me not to put his team in the playoffs. There's a lot of much better players than him, but most of those players are going to be playing 60 games a season. Most of those players are pretty confident they're going to be in the playoffs already. He, on the other hand, is going to have to fight for everything. So I have him very high on him. I think he could finish, like I said, around sixth in MVP voting. Only problem I have with that is that, like you said, every other player on the Pistons is pretty bad. I think Andre Drummond is actively not a good basketball player. I mentioned this last week, but he is an elite rebounder, except for the fact that when he's off the floor, the team actually has a higher rebounding rate. So he's pretty much not useful for anything. Reggie Jackson, famously the first on-ball player that Russell Westbrook hated playing with. So that's pretty cool for him. The other guy that was true for, Victor Oladipo, became a superstar-ish type player when he left. Famous enough to be on The Masked Singer, I guess. Reggie Jackson became the fourth best player at the time on the Pistons, and thanks to some departures is now the second or third best player on the Pistons.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the three players they added for 5 seconds. Derrick Rose.
No.
In the draft, they added Sekou Doumbouya, who could be fine, but no.
Maybe.
And then Markieff Morris. Big no.
Markieff Morris, the second best Morris. Derrick Rose, the Timberwolves. First of all, we were told this man was an all-star 60 games in the last season. And then the Timberwolves let him go for pretty much free. No interest in him. Didn't care. Turns out you do not need a scoring guard who's wildly inefficient and has no real elite NBA skills just because he put up 145-point game on ESPN once. Derrick Rose is no longer a good basketball player, and we've seen enough to prove him that. Sekou Doumbouya is 2 years away from being a good player, and Markieff Morris is the second-best Morris twin. So,
yeah. All right, moving on. Our seventh team in the East is the Orlando Magic. You had them at eight. I had them at seven. They have an interesting team. And this team is all of a sudden made a whole lot more interesting if my Markel Fultz stock comes through, because if he's even a reasonable player and they can actually have a ball handler that's not DJ Augustine or Michael Carter Williams, that elevates them to, you know, maybe even up to the fifth seed, because they have some talent. Don't have a lot of shooting. They made some kind of bizarre free agent signings in Al-Farouq Aminu. And who is the other guy that they added that's pretty much Al-Farouq Aminu? Can't think.
I wanted to say it was... who is the other guy they added? Because they got rid of basically another Al-Farouq Aminu in Jonathan Simmons. Yeah. So it's not Simmons they added. They added somebody else. I'll go look at the Orlando Magic cap sheet right now. But the Orlando Magic, pretty firmly... a team where you need to look up their roster.
Yeah, and they do. And from all accounts, Mo Bamba's actually looked really good this preseason. Jonathan Isaac was actually actively pretty good the last part of last season. And if he can make an improvement, that could be a big deal.
Kem Birch weirdly matters a lot for this team.
Kem Birch is there. Nikola Vucevic.
Terrence Ross weirdly matters a lot for this team.
Terrence Ross, also a good player, someone I would have liked to see on the Blazers. Vucevic obviously is still there. Michael Carter Williams is somehow playing still, one of the other 76er castoffs. We have Aaron Gordon, who's still there temporarily. Hopefully he can take a little bit of a leap this year. They're going to be really, really good on defense. Obviously, they're coached by Steve Clifford, who is a you know, may not be good at a lot of things, but he's a pretty good defensive coach, and they have a lot of length. And again, I keep in my Markel stock. I'm hoping he makes a lot of Sixers fans really upset this year by turning into a 10.5 assists a game scorer, and then maybe going even better next year. He at least looks very confident. He's still not shooting a lot, but he looks much more confident in the open court and showing a lot more like he did at Washington when he was there. Really excited to see what he can do this year. Maybe I'll even watch a few Magic games.
I wouldn't go that far. I think it would be hard to go as far as I'll watch a few Magic games. I do, however, think that they are a pretty solid little 42-43 win in the East team, which is really all they need to be. I really am excited about Markel Fultz. I'm kind of very excited about Markel Fultz. But unfortunately, I was very excited about Markel Fultz in college, and I also watched zero games of him at Washington. A lot of YouTube highlights, zero live games. You tried to get me to watch a live game when we lived together that year, and I did not.
See, my thing with Markel Fultz is, as I just mentioned, if he has a few 20-point games at the beginning of the season, it'll just be so enjoyable to watch all the Sixers fans like self-destruct. And that's really what I'm looking forward to. Other than that, Magic, somewhat interesting. Jonathan Isaac, as I mentioned, is someone who could really blossom a little bit this year. But other than that, well, I think you're right on probably 42-43 win, 7th or 8th seed. Our 6th seed in the East is the Toronto Raptors, who obviously are defending champions. That's what losing Kawhi Leonard will do for you. As of now, they still have pretty much every other piece outside of Kawhi and Danny Green, who were two big pieces. They obviously just signed Kyle Lowry to a 1-year, $31 million extension, which was probably the right move. But I think 6 seed is about right. The interesting piece is what Siakam and Anunoby can turn into, particularly Siakam. This is a team that I think a lot of people are just expecting, including myself, to kind of hang around the mid-tier of the Eastern Conference. There's a chance they're a little better than we think they are, especially with the uncertainty surrounding a couple of the teams that are directly above them. But overall, I think 6 is about right for them.
Yep, I'm pretty comfortable at 6. This is really going to be Pascal Siakam's team. It's going to be fun to see that. I'm still very high on Marc Gasol, as I mentioned last week. I'm still fairly high on Kyle Lowry. I've never really loved him. He's still a great player. But this is the East. They'll be fine. They probably won't really contend for anything. They'll have a nice victory lap season. They certainly won't embarrass themselves. They'll certainly have at least one All-Star. That should be enough for it to be a good season for them.
Yeah, so our 5th team is the Brooklyn Nets. You have them at 6. I have them at 5. They obviously don't have Kevin Durant. They might not have Kyrie Irving because he broke his face or something. I don't know what happened to him. But they didn't really lose a lot of what they had last year. They still have the majority of the same pieces. I mean, I think DeAndre Jordan is a subtraction by addition. But other than that, they have pretty much the same team. It's healthy. You got Caris LeVert, Jared Allen. They added Torian Prince, who's been really, really good and who I think is an underrated player. So they could have a really nice little starting lineup of Kyrie, LeVert. Sounds like DeAndre Jordan, unfortunately, has promised a starting spot for no apparent reason. And then who else do they have on that team? Those European guys.
Dinwiddie off the bench.
Yeah, and they have Dinwiddie, Crooks, LeVert, all those guys. Jared Allen, who will now be coming off the bench. Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, all these guys. So I think they're going to be a top 5 seed. I would be surprised if they're not. You know, Kyrie could potentially ruin things, but I think he's at least has to be a little bit more cautious this year after kind of being universally hated on all sides of the spectrum last year. But I think they're significantly better and more talented than the 3 teams I had below them.
Yeah, I think it's pretty safe to say that they're significantly more talented than the 3 teams you have below them. Unfortunately, a big part of that talent's going to miss the season, torn Achilles for Kevin Durant. And I'm not sure I'd want him coming back even if he could be back for the playoffs, simply because this isn't going to win. They're not going to win the East with him, so they should wait till next year and give it a real shot. Their 3 best players, assuming KD doesn't play, are all point guards. That's the biggest concern I have. But they seem pretty comfortable playing Caris LeVert next to Kyrie Irving already. So that's a concern pretty quickly alleviated. And Spencer Dinwiddie's getting paid a ridiculously low rate. We'll have no problem coming off the bench. Unfortunately, their fourth best player is a center who, like you mentioned, he is coming off the bench for no clear reason other than DeAndre Jordan is friends with both Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving. It's a very strange choice. I don't think he should be on this team at all, but apparently it was contingent to get two truly great players, so they added him. I'm not sure he should be in the league at all, but DeAndre Jordan's here, and he's starting. Their biggest asset is that they got better from last year because they replaced the up-and-coming version of Kyrie Irving with actual Kyrie Irving. But their biggest problem is that actual Kyrie Irving carried a lot more baggage.
Moving on to the top four, which is a little more interesting. We both have the Celtics at four. This is a team that could be really, really good pending significant growth from Jason Tatum, which it's just really hard to predict at this point. But they also are missing a lot of the depth and defensive ability that they've had in past years. Obviously, no more Aaron Baines. They're short on you know, just useful pieces off the bench that they've had. They still have Marcus Smart still there. But their starting center situation seems to be Robert Williams at this time. Enes Kanter, but Robert Williams will play. Both all three of those guys that we just mentioned, Daniel Theis, Enes Kanter, and Robert Williams, will all play significant minutes because they're the only three big guys on their roster. So it's really going to come down to Brown, Tatum, and Kemba Walker, which is probably how it should be.
And Gordon Hayward potentially being great against them.
Yes.
That's not the big if. I think it's a little bit of an overstatement of how much better Hayward's gotten this year, considering what we've seen in the preseason. But everybody in that locker room seems to suddenly like him, which is a big change from last year. But everyone in that locker room seems to suddenly like each other, which is a big change from last year, and that's what happens when you get rid of Kyrie Irving. Marcus Smart is my favorite player on that team, and he is my X factor because we already have talked long enough about Jason Tatum's ceiling before. Marcus Smart, to me, has a similarly high ceiling just because he's such an unbelievably dominating presence for a point guard on defense. And offensively, he can do enough that it doesn't really matter. We've all seen the clip this season of him doing a little Steph Curry shimmy turnaround after hitting a three without looking and running back across the other side of the court. Marcus Smart is, as Celtics Twitter loves to note, the best defensive center in the East. It's only a little wrong. I think Joel Embiid might genuinely be the only better defensive center in the East. He's a 1-5 defender who's about 6'1", so you gotta love him. The rest of the team you can pretty much take or leave, but they you can't not have them in the top four simply because of the amount of talent they have on the roster.
Yeah, there's some not so subtle Ewing theory potential here for sure. And also, if they can just get back to the way they were 2 years ago with a somewhat similar roster, Brad Stevens can actually coach the team now that Kyrie Irving is gone. People seem to turn on Brad Stevens because he's not really a type of guy who's going to really get in your face. But now that he has a team that doesn't really have a whole lot of egos, I think he should be able to return back to the great Brad Stevens that we all loved. First years in Boston and the Butler years. Number three, we have the Indiana Pacers. We agreed on the entire top four. Well, no, we didn't. We didn't agree on the order. But the Indiana Pacers, we both had at three. We talked actually a pretty good amount about the Pacers roster construction when we were talking about Malcolm Brogdon for some reason, I think, in our player rankings. But they're a team that's going to be really interesting to see how it's built, especially once Oladipo gets back. Because we've talked about, and everyone under the sun's in the NBA world has talked about how Turner and Sabonis don't really work together. A lot of people have talked about Sabonis for Jaylen Brown trades, which I think everyone would be in favor of. I think they're going to be a very consistent team throughout the year. I think they're probably a 50-win team. That probably isn't really a threat in the playoffs, but that's what you get third in the East.
Right. And so much of it's really dependent on when Victor Oladipo comes back from his fifth on the Masked Singer. So it's a problem when your best player is out for potentially half the season, but it says a lot about what we think of this team that we still have him at third despite that. Obviously, very, very, very nice little signing they had taking Malcolm Brogdon away from the Bucks. I think basically essentially what they did with their cap space was trade him for Bojan Bogdanovic. I think that was the right move. I think that makes the team better. And I definitely think he'll fill the role that Bojan did at the end of last season better. I do have questions about what they're going to do, even if they do trade Sabonis away, what they're going to do to integrate somebody like Jaylen Brown, or presumably anybody they get would be a wing, into an offense that pretty much runs swimmingly as is and doesn't need more ball handlers. But if they do it right, that could be what gets into a championship ceiling. And if they don't, then maybe Sabonis and Turner will finally figure it out. It's been 3 years. In theory, it'll work just because Miles Turner blocks shots and shoots threes, and Sabonis does more of a center power forward reverse on defense and offense. So theoretically, they're a good fit, but in practice, they just can't seem to play together.
Yeah. It'll be interesting there. I mean, again, with these top four, everyone except, you know, I think that the Nets are realistically the only team that could knock off one of the top four in a 4-5 matchup. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think we're pretty locked in the top four, similarly to what we had. We're looking at last year. The second team we have is the 76ers. I think we both think that they're the most talented team in the East. They're huge, but really, really loaded from 1 to 5. Probably the best starting lineup in the league overall. And certainly in the East, maybe not overall, but talent-wise, I think it's not wrong to say that they're the most talented starting lineup in the NBA. It all depends on Ben Simmons, as we've talked about ad nauseum. I think Josh Richardson's really underrated. I think he's going to be really good for them. He's a better shooter than they've had at that position for a long time. Embiid needs to stay healthy and fit, but if everything comes together for them, I think they should be the favorite in the East in the playoffs.
I think I'm sure as an avid reader of the league pass rankings every year, you saw that they were number one in Zach Lowe's rankings. I was excited to see that because I thought I was the only person who was really excited about this team. Not seeing a lot of conversation about them as an actual fun to watch team, but I think they're going to be incredibly fun just because they have four power forwards and Josh Richardson, which is cool. It's cool.
I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
It's a novel team. It's a novel construction, and it's really amazing to see what's really the closest thing we have to a super team right now. I mentioned the Jazz earlier. They're the only other team I think has a complete 1-5 starting lineup. They're going to be a lot of fun to watch try to come together cohesively. If it works, I think it'll be them losing to the Clippers in the championship, just because I still have that much faith in Paul George and Kawhi Leonard. If it doesn't work, their floor is still probably fourth in the East. And the bigger concern if it doesn't work is what you do with Ben Simmons, who you've already signed to this extension. Do you maybe start talking about trading him at that point? Do you maybe start talking about trying to move Tobias Harris, who's on an above-market deal, for somebody who's a smaller player that's more fit? Tobias Harris famously really struggled playing small forward to the point where Danilo Gallinari became a small forward just so he could become a power forward, because he was really struggling to defend wings to that extent on the Clippers. And now he's going to be asked to sometimes even be defending shooting guards just because of Ben Simmons' defensive versatility. He might be in a situation where if the shooting guard is someone to hide on, if the small forward isn't, he's going to be guarding somebody maybe a Will Barton while you're working on. Maybe if you're talking about if Michael Porter Jr. is in the starting lineup for the Nuggets, certainly Ben Simmons would be on him. And that's when you're talking about a real danger zone for him defensively. Other than that, I see no real weaknesses on this team other than fit and realistically ability to get things to actually work together. But that was also true of the Celtics 2 years ago, and they did not get things to work together. So who knows?
Yeah, see, I don't dislike the fit so much as most people do. I think Horford and Josh Richardson are both better shooters than they have. It's just because they're both kind of unconventional better shooters, as they play big. They're big, both relatively large. Obviously, Horford is a center and Richardson is a small forward. But they haven't had, you know, looking back when we have the James Ennis's and the Jonathan Simmons and the Furkan Korkmaz's and all those guys. So these two are obviously clear upgrades to those guys. Everyone's talked about how not having Horford on the Celtics makes it worth it. Even if he's not that good on the Sixers, not having him on the Celtics makes it hugely worth it. And I think as we mentioned, the issue is still, even with the additions, it's does Embiid and Simmons work together? Because I actually think their additions have been really, really good. And I think they'll work out fine. It just really, can Ben Simmons get better, and will he work with Embiid?
Yeah, I would agree 100% on there's nothing really to lose with Al Horford. I also would agree 100% with maybe the better part of that signing is him not being on the Celtics.
Yeah.
I'm really excited to see how he can bring this locker room together, bring this team together. especially because one of the smaller issues that people haven't really been talking about that much because it's so different and less important than the locker room issues with the Celtics is that Embiid seems to be beloved by every player that's ever played for the Philadelphia 76ers, and Ben Simmons doesn't even seem to like being on a basketball team. So I'm really hoping that that is something that presence of Al Horford can change. Celtics Twitter will tell you he was that team's dad. Maybe this team needs a dad. Maybe that'll help their fit together on court as well.
Yeah, well, that leads us to our number one team is the Milwaukee Bucks. They have the defending MVP who looks to have gotten even better. They lost Malcolm Brogdon. I think it's being slightly overrated how big a loss that was. I actually think they got Wesley Matthews back, and Wesley Matthews, since his Achilles, has actually been reasonably healthy for the most part. He does the majority of what Brogdon does, not quite as good a ball handler, obviously, but I think he's a really, really good fit next to Giannis. He's still a 40% shooter from three, great defender. When he was in Portland, he was one of my favorite players. I think he can really fit what they do, and I don't think you think it'll at least partially offset the loss of Brogdon. And of course you have the two Lopez brothers who should form a super Lopez brother and carry them to championship glory.
I'm very excited for just the Twitter concept of the Lopez brothers being teammates. That's going to be fantastic. Apparently Brooke shoots threes as well as Robin now. I'm sorry, Robin shoots threes as well as Brooke now. That's the buzz out of Bucks training camp. I don't believe that.
I can't see him having like the little sidestep thing that Brooke does. He's just
he doesn't quite have the swagger yet, but
I guess more the Myers Leonard type 3-point shot where it takes about 5 seconds to load before he shoots, but
floor spacing is floor spacing. I'm really excited to see a Lopez back up a Lopez. That's gonna be fun. I'm a little bit worried about what this team looks like without what was realistically its best point guard of its three good point guards, but they still have George Hill, and once he gets healthy, they'll still have another good point guard, even if he's disappearing in the playoffs. Eric Bledsoe is no worries whatsoever in the regular season, and if he does disappear in the playoffs again, worst case scenario, you just play George Hill and you put him on the bench. We'll see what this team could really do in these situations. We'll see if Chris Middleton's for real. I think we all agree that Max contract's an overpay, but he deserves enough like it that it doesn't really matter. But we all know Giannis is for real. We all know Giannis is going to be a top, 3-1 player in the NBA for the next 10 years. It's something we have to change catastrophically for that not to happen. There would need to be three more Zion Williamsons in the pipeline for that not to happen, essentially what would need to be. So it would be hard not to be excited about this team. If he does only stay there the next 2 years, suddenly the pressure is very high to win a title this year in particular. Because if he wins a title this year, then there's no way he doesn't sign that Supermax. But if they don't this year, maybe he'll make up his mind before he can win next year, and we have a Kawhi Leonard situation on our hands.
Yeah. I'm rooting for them. I really want them to win a title with Giannis there. So if he ends up leaving, they at least have something out of that. What's been probably the best draft pick of the last two or three decades.
The neutral observer in me, I think the main thing I took away from basically LeBron's career is I don't really mind a player leaving a team he won a title with to go wherever he wants. That's why I had no problems with Kawhi Leonard leaving overnight to go to the Clippers. He came there to win a title. He did so when he left. So I would like to see Giannis, if he wants to leave that team, do so, owing them nothing. That would be fun. That'd be great.
Yeah. All right, so that wraps up our Eastern Conference rankings. We were going to talk about a few Western Conference teams really fast who we omitted from our top eight, who have a shot at the top eight. We'll start with the Pelicans, who seems to be everyone's little darling. Zion's obviously looked really, really good in the preseason, as has Nikhil Alexander-Walker. What's your 30 seconds on the Pelicans?
They just won a game for the first time. Last night or the night before, I believe. They only did so because Zion Williamson was being shut down by Jakob Poeltl, and then Jakob Poeltl did not play in the second half. So I don't really think that this is a team that's going to be winning a lot of games, but I think this is a team that's obviously going to be fun to watch, have great players, be on national TV a lot. Zion's probably going to average 20-10 as a rookie, almost certainly going to be rookie of the year. Nikhil Alexander-Walker right now looks like the second best player in this class, which is crazy. And Jackson Hayes is a lot of fun. So I'm going to watch a lot of Pelicans games. I think they're probably about a 28-win team.
Yeah, second team are the Oklahoma City Thunder. I don't hate their roster. It seems like they've been playing the four-point guard lineup, which is kind of bizarre, with Chris Paul, Dennis Schroeder, What's his name?
Shai Gilgeous-Alexander.
Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Aces only. He's only three. I thought they were playing a four point guard lineup. Maybe not. But yeah, they've been playing some bizarre lineups. Billy Donovan's offense, I think, really stagnated because of Westbrook. Not necessarily because it was Westbrook's fault, but if you watched any of his, the way he coached at Florida, it was much more kind of flowy and passing oriented. It's hard to do that with someone like Russell Westbrook. So I think this could actually work out okay for them. So I don't think they're a playoff team, but it should be fun to see SGA and Chris Paul and Gallinari and Steven Adams and those guys. They have some talent for sure.
Yeah, I think Gallinari is really underrated. Gallinari was an excellent, excellent player on the Clippers last year, and it doesn't really matter that he left because they replaced him with Paul George, who's better at literally everything. But Gallinari is probably going to be a player that gets another 20-point season and gets talked about as a very good player again, probably still not an all-star. Chris Paul could easily, if this team makes the playoffs, Chris Paul will be in the MVP conversation at 36, whatever years old. But obviously that's a big ask. More likely this team wins 20 games and Chris Paul averages 22 points and 8 assists on a pointless team. But, you know, it's a team to watch. It's just not a team to watch that close.
Yeah. Then the last team is the Dallas Mavericks. Looks like KP and Luka are both healthy. The problem is, I think we all know on that team, their third best player is either...
J.J. Barrett.
Yeah, or... Goodness.
The German guy,
Maxi Kleber, or Tim Hardaway Jr., someone like that. They really have nothing behind any of those. Seth Curry, maybe. They got Seth Curry back, which is good.
Seth Curry's almost definitely their third best player.
But KP would have to be really, really good for them to be close to the playoffs. I think both the Thunder and the Pelicans, and certainly, especially the Pelicans, both have a better shot at that. And we didn't talk about the Spurs, who I had ranked, but you did not. So I think realistically, as we said earlier, it's between the Kings and the Spurs for that eighth spot, and possibly the Warriors, depending on injuries.
Right. The it's entirely possible that the Pelicans and Mavericks could play up, or even the Grizzlies, even though that seems crazy right now. But it's also entirely possible that the Warriors play down. But if nothing really changes, it's pretty comfortably going to be the Kings and Spurs, and it really depends. If you like the Kings roster or not is really the question here, because everybody's pretty much feeling the same way about the Spurs. That's a team that's incapable of having a losing season, and it's got enough talent that it could still do it if it needs to.
Yeah. All right, well, that'll wrap it up for part two of our NBA preview. We're a week away now? 1 week?
Week and a day.
Week and a day.
Before we go, will you give me quickly, with no analysis, your award winners?
Oh, yeah, we'll do MVPs. MVP, I mentioned Steph Curry. Rookie of the Year, I think, will be Zion. What other awards do we have? Defensive Player of the Year. I think Kawhi, if he plays enough games, because that team's going to be really good defensively anyways. But I think that could also go to someone like... what's his name? I can't even think of names right now. I don't know. I'll think of it
later. This is the problem with recording in the daytime.
Yeah.
I had the same issue earlier. I couldn't remember Donovan Mitchell. For Defensive Player of the Year, I have Giannis Antetokounmpo, if that helps you at all.
It was not Giannis. It was someone slightly lesser. But anyways, not a big deal. Most Improved, I would give it to Siakam again if that was possible. Did he win it last year?
He did win it last year.
Yeah, I would give it to him again if possible, but I don't think that's possible. So instead, I will give it to Zach Collins. Go Zach Collins.
Okay, Zach Collins. I can actually
give me
see
Zach
that.
Collins.
Sixth Man of the Year.
Sixth Man of the Year. I think I could see any of the two Clippers guys winning it again, Harrell or Lou Williams. I could also see Eric Gordon winning it again. I could also see someone like Spencer Dinwiddie winning it if the Nets are good. Those are my top three, I think.
That's pretty solid. I think you're missing my obvious pick, but I think I have a little bias there. First, I'm going to start with MVP. I have Kawhi because I think he needs one for narrative purposes, and I think for narrative purposes, Giannis isn't going to get the votes he deserves this year. So just to complete his resume, because we know Kawhi has been one of the three best players the last 10 years, he needs to win an MVP award. I think this is the year that happens. In return, since Giannis is obviously going to win at least two more this year, he might be the best player, but he won't win it, so I have him finishing second. I have Nikola Jokic finishing third. And then after that, it's a bit of a jumble of players depending on how much they play. Rookie of the Year is unquestionably Zion Williamson. Defensive Player of the Year is Giannis because he won't win MVP. Sixth Man of the Year is Bogdan Bogdanovic because I think he is the best player on a bench this season. I think Montrezl Harrell is pretty easily the second best player. So I kind of had a tough time with that, but I picked Bogdanovic because I can't say no to my guy. Got to support him, especially because there's a very real chance that he doesn't get extended this year when Buddy Hield gets a max contract. And Most Improved Player was really tough for me because I just remember the award existed 3 minutes ago. So I've been thinking of some guys. I thought Shai Gilgeous-Alexander has a lot of potential. I also thought Justice Winslow has a lot of potential. But the problem is, if I don't think that the Heat are going to make the playoffs, how can I put Justice Winslow there?
Give it to Myers Leonard. Myers Leonard's the most improved.
Yeah, but I don't think the Thunder anybody expects to make the playoffs, so them finishing 11th in the West could be no surprise. So if Shai is their best player, which seems very possible, if Chris Paul becomes old, then I think he wins the award.
Fair enough. All right. Well, we're very excited. Actually, we haven't been able to do much NFL talk. We'll try to integrate a little bit of NFL into our next recording.
Here's some NFL talk for you. The 49ers defense is good.
It is good. I feel bad for the Falcons. Seahawks and the NFC West is somehow the best division in football. The Rams look bad. Marcus Mariota got benched. Chiefs look very vulnerable. The Bears suck. Deshaun Watson looks awesome. The Chargers have no fans. That's about it.
That's pretty much it. I think that sums it up. The Patriots should go away because they're not fun or interesting to watch anymore.
Yes. All right. That'll wrap it up. Hopefully, we'll be back soon.